History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions. And then to be patient enough to listen intently as memories that may have been buried for decades return to the surface again. Our goal, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And what we always find is that in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In our last episode, we prepared you for the 81st anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor through the memories of three Pearl Harbor survivors who were still with us all past the century mark. Wednesday, December 7th was that 81st anniversary, and that rallying cry that echoed throughout the U.S. 8 decades ago, Remember Pearl Harbor, was carried out all across our country. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find video links for official ceremonies at both the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and from Pearl Harbor, where just 6 survivors of the attack were able to make it this year for the observance. It's nearly 5,000 miles between those two pieces of hallowed ground, two spots where people gather every day to honor and remember. But Pearl Harbor was also remembered in big cities and smaller hometowns all across America this week. And let's hope it always is. I had the privilege of observing Pearl Harbor Day this year in Clovis, California, at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District with 102-year-old Frank Paredes. You heard some of his story on our last episode, and those who gathered there in Clovis on Pearl Harbor Day heard some of his memories from December 7th, and they got a big taste of his resilient spirit. As refreshments were served afterwards, some inquisitive grade schoolers quizzed Frank and Air Force veteran Bill Tokomoto, who as a 7-year-old civilian on Oahu on that day of infamy, had witnessed a dogfight between American and Japanese aircraft. Another veteran you heard on our last episode, USS Oklahoma survivor George Coburn, had quite an adventure on Pearl Harbor Day in Oceanside, California this year. The nonprofit Dream Flights took George up in a vintage Stearman biplane and gave him a bird's-eye view of his native San Diego at age 102. In many spots across the land, a single Pearl Harbor survivor, like Dick Higgins in Bend, Oregon, marked a final living link to that day of infamy. And we know it's not going to be long until all the survivors are gone. But what they've lived these last 81 years for is to make sure the rest of us never forget. Again, I have a link to video of the official remembrance at Pearl Harbor for you at hometownheroesradio.com, but here is how that ceremony began.
Unfortunately, we recognize that we could not have all the veterans with us on site, though they are not with us here, they are not forgotten. With that in mind, at this time, we would like to present a special welcome message from Lou Conter, a Pearl Harbor survivor who was stationed aboard the USS Arizona on the morning of December 7th. Lou will honor all of the veterans who could not make it to today's ceremony, but who still hold a special place in our hearts and in our thoughts.
Hello, is an audio recording. I'm Lou Conter, a Pearl Harbor survivor and World War II veteran. I am one of 2 remaining survivors from the USS Arizona. My remaining shipmate, Ken Potts, lives in Provo, Utah. I had hoped to be with you in Honolulu for this 81st commemoration, but my 101-year-old legs are not what they used to be. Back in 1941, most of us stationed at Pearl Harbor were in our teens or 20s. As quartermaster of the watch on December 7th, 1941, I remember it was beautiful Sunday morning. The Arizona band members were gathering on the ship deck to play colors at 0800. But before they could finish setting up, they heard the unmistakable whine of flying planes. The rising sun on the planes told us that this was not a drill. We manned our battle stations on the relentless strafing and bombing. But the damage to the Arizona was severe. We took a heavy bomb alongside the starboard side forward, a number two turret, and it went through five decks into the lower handling room and exploded the forward magazines, which had all the powder, a million pounds of powder for the 14-inch guns. We then started helping the men within the flames come out of the fire, helping them lay down until we could get them over the boats to get them to the hospital. I've been back for many commemorations, and each time I am on the Arizona Memorial, I take a moment to view the names of my shipmates and thank God for their ultimate sacrificing. Thank you all for attending this important commemoration in person, and those of you who are watching on a stream. Your interest in preserving World War II history is vital and important. We need to make some future generations understand what Pearl Harbor really was about and what was at stake. Our schools need to teach more than a paragraph on Pearl Harbor. I've briefed a lot of high schools and junior high schools, and they're all happy to have the truth come out and what really happened. In their history books, there's only a half a page on Pearl Harbor. They should have at least a chapter, if not more, because that's a very important part of history and for our children to teach their children and remember. Thank you to the organizers of this gathering for dedicating this commemoration to the greatest generation. That includes those who served in uniform and those who worked on the home front. The heroes are the ones that didn't come home, the ones that lost their lives, the 2,403 members of the military that lost their lives that day, including 1,177 of my shipmates on the Arizona. Thank you, my wonderful family, for being constantly supportive. One of my proudest and most commemorative was last year when I pinned my pilot's badge, which I had received in November 1942, on my great nephew, Marine Captain Ray Hauer. What an amazing 100th birthday present it was for me. Thank you all. I hope to see you all next year, getting my legs in good shape. Thank you very much, and remember Pearl Harbor.
Powerful words from one of the last two survivors of the USS Arizona, Lew Conter, heard by a crowd of roughly 2,500 at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 2022. That's a crowd whose size just about matched the number of lives lost there 81 years ago. Something else happened this week that certainly could be overlooked. In Rhode Island, on December 8th, 2022, a keel-laying ceremony for a new submarine that will carry the name USS Arizona. It featured the granddaughter of USS Arizona survivor Dawn Stratton, Nikki Stratton, welding her initials on a steel plate that will adorn that new sub. Dawn Stratton's tale of his ordeal on December 7th, 1941 is one that you can't help but be gripped by. It's told in the best-selling book All the Gallant Men, which the family hopes will someday become a feature film to help extend that Pearl Harbor legacy. And while he was still with us, Dawn also shared his story on Hometown Heroes.
How did you experience that morning? What's the first thing you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Oh, it was nothing. It was just quarter for muster, and then we had chow, and then we had colors, and whatever. So it was just a normal day for us.
So what was the first indication that it wasn't a normal day?
Well, it was just we had a little notice there, and they had the sound general quarters, and everybody was on duty. So here and there and aboard ship, my battle station was a sight setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side. And that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that told us a heaving line that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and they small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
And how did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number 2 turret went into a million pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. And that just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. 6 of us went across there.
I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy, but I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You try to figure out what to do. That's it.
Are you looking around? Are you watching what's happening? Are you closing your eyes and praying?
No, you're just trying to get out of the way from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heave line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and there was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burned. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach. And they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most generally figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties. But it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of a lot of patience. And
yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, that they didn't. They got a notice that I hadn't made, didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. So, but they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of skin grafts and a lot of stuff, a lot of baths, and a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us in on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went through boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff. And I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406, USS Stack, STACK. And we headed for the South Pacific right away. And we were in on the invasion, the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps and the destroyers protecting them, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and one time there was over 100 ships and sunk and damaged in Karamret or Wise Man Cove at that time. And then they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that and that you've told your story many times, so that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess.
Was it?
Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said, if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live.
Did you feel that you were avenging the deaths of your shipmates?
Not really. It was just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed close to 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
Just hearing Don Stratton's voice again takes me back to his living room in Colorado Springs. I can picture his fingerprintless hands forever altered on that day of infamy, showing me a piece of his ship, the USS Arizona, a piece that's now on display at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs. That is definitely worth a visit. Don's book, All the Gallant Men, is definitely worth the read. And speaking of USS Arizona artifacts, another piece of that battleship is the latest addition to the World War II collection at the Central Coast Veterans Museum in San Luis Obispo, California, where we've had loyal Hometown Heroes listeners for over a decade now. So if you're in that area, California's Central Coast, or visiting there, check it out. When we come back, more from the 81st anniversary ceremony at Pearl Harbor and more memories from men who survived that day of infamy. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.